Master of Studies here of the Oxford University Department of Continuing Education Philosophy Department. She is also the president of our Philosophical Society, which we're very honoured to have her as our president. She has also got what I'm told is the world's most popular podcast site, millions of hits on that. And if you haven't listened to Marianne's podcast, can I say you really should do, because they are excellent. And Marianne's got a website that you can go into and you'll find all of her podcasts there. She has also written a number of books, and one of them is this one, Keeping Mum, which she has very kindly bought copies of today. And if you would like to buy a copy, they are how much, Marianne?
They're actually £8.99, but that's a bit of a nuisance because everyone gives me £10 notes, and therefore I've got to have £1.01 for.
Right.
So I think I might make them £8 or even £5. I'll think about that when I'm.
Right. Okay. And she's very kindly agreed that she would sign them for anybody who would like to buy one of those. So Marianne's talk today is the philosophical problems that arise when caring for someone with dementia. Thank you, Marianne.
This is not something I usually talk about with my philosophy hat on. I often talk about dementia, but I don't often talk about philosophy and dementia together, so you'll have to bear with me. So, this is my mum and dad on their wedding day. You'll notice that it's November 1939, so I'm sure I don't have to tell you, whereas I do have to tell most sixth formers why that date is quite important. So they were one of the thousands of couples who after the war started, got married in rather a rush, as it were. But they weathered the storm, and this is them 50 years later in their garden. This is a very characteristic photograph. It's my favourite photograph, but you'll see that it was before the days of electronic photographs, because I had to do all sorts of shenanigans to get it on. Okay, so that's Mum and Dad, 50 years later. Now, I'm going to give you some facts. 1996, Dad had a massive stroke. He was very fit and healthy, always had been. He was 80 years old, and he walked down to the village, which was 45 minutes away, and he was crossing the road, and he fell as he got to the other side, and lots of people rushed to him the way you would when you see an elderly person fall down. And they thought he'd tripped over the curb, but he hadn't tripped over the curb. He'd had a massive stroke, and he became demented overnight. So that was vascular dementia, and probably had a lot to do with the 60 cigarettes a day he'd smoked since the age of about 16. So actually, if he hadn't smoked, he'd have probably lived forever. So 1996, he had this massive stroke. Very distressing, especially for mum, as you can imagine. 1998, Dad went into a home. He actually went into a home fairly soon after having the stroke, but the home was so awful, he thought he was at school, and he kept asking Mum to take him home, and Mum thought she couldn't take him home, but eventually she thought this is ridiculous, and she got his bag and packed him up and took him home. So she cared for him for 2 years. But then the doctor rang me and said that he had put Dad in a home, and I went ballistic. And he said, look, if I hadn't put your father in a home, your mother wouldn't have lasted another month. 10 years later, they said that of me. I hope they don't think that I was about to pop my clogs, but they were thinking that of mum. So he went into a home. The following year, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And the year after that, Dad died. So it was very sad because that she had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, she had always, this sounds awful, she had always wanted to try living alone. She thought she'd be good at it. But she never had a chance to live alone because the only time she lived alone was after this diagnosis, and she wasn't in any real fit state to enjoy living alone. In 2003, she came to live with me. Well, she would have come a lot earlier if I could have organised this earlier. But I had to sell my house, I had to sell her house, I had to buy another house. There were all sorts of things that had to be arranged. So by the time she came to live with me, she should have been living with me for ages. I had turned off, I'd got an isolation valve on the cooker, turned off her fire. She had no home comforts, so she loved looking at the living flame on her gas fire, but the gas fire is out because I had turned it out. She loved cooking for herself, but the gas cooker didn't work because I had turned it off, and all these things. So it was very tough, those couple of years. 2008, I hit a brick wall. I couldn't care for her anymore, and you'll hear more about that in a minute. So she went into a home, which was a wonderful thing. It was a wonderful home as it happened. And 6 months after, she died. So she really was end stage by the time she went into a home. Okay, so those are the facts. Let's have a look at some of the moral problems that that brings up. Well, the first one was making the decision to bring her to live with me. In our culture, on the whole, we tend not to do this. So it was a very big decision to make. I first assumed that she would go into a home, and I went to visit homes. But I went to visit homes with dementia because she had a diagnosis of dementia at the time. And so I thought, you know, she couldn't go into a residential home. So the homes I visited were homes for people with dementia. And it's a horrible fright to send someone who has very little experience of dementia, as was the case with me at that time, to a home for people with dementia, because I now see what a good job they do under very difficult circumstances. At that time, I wasn't aware of what the difficult circumstances are and what a good job they could be doing. I was just horrified. And I thought, I can't do this to my mother. So I agonised. I went through, I used to go on long, long walks, and I used to think, well, I could buy the house next to me and we could knock it through, and, you know, but have you seen house prices in Oxford? So that was out. All sorts of other things. And in the end, I was thinking, well, I've always lived alone. I liked living alone. But if I could live with anyone, it would be my mum. Maybe I should bring her to live with me. And I thought about this unendingly for ages. What are my non-negotiables? How would I be able to get them with mum with me? What are mum's non-negotiables? Would I be able to provide them if she came to live with me, etc.? Moral theory, my knowledge of moral theory is completely useless. Others' views were very interesting. I did notice that nearly everybody else was a utilitarian, but their utilitarianism was being misapplied, because what they were saying is that you can't bring your mum to live with me, what about you? I.e., what about my happiness? They all thought my happiness would be shot if mum came to live with me, which is hardly the point. That is not what utilitarianism is. You don't think only of your own happiness, you think of the happiness of the greatest happiness of the greatest number. So mum's happiness counted. My siblings' happiness counts, though I don't count it very high.
Your sister.
So for me, deontology seemed to fit the bill more. Once I had thought of mum living with me, it became a duty. Not a duty as opposed to something I wanted to do, but it seemed to me to be something that had to be done. If you love somebody, as I say in the blog from which you have various handouts, you've got hostage to fortune, haven't you? I mean, anyone who has a child knows this. If something goes wrong with that person that you love, you've got to do something about it. If you're the only one who can do something, well, even if you're not the only one, you do it. And that's how it seemed to me. So moral theory was of limited use, but I just tell you these things because it was interesting that, yes, for me it was deontology, for everyone else it was utilitarianism. But it's also difficult to identify motivations. Was I bringing mum to live with me because I would have felt guilty if I hadn't, and I didn't want to feel guilty? And you can see that that would be a mismotivation in a way. So there are all sorts of questions that you need to ask yourself, but if you ask yourself too many questions, you'll never get to the end and never do anything. I'm always glad that I did ask mum to live with me. Okay, so This I hated. Everyone called me a saint. I am not a saint. I never was a saint. I'm not saint-like in any way or form. And it used to bother me that people called me a saint, because they didn't really think this. They were putting me on the moral high ground. And it was partly to excuse themselves, it seems to me. So there was something special about me that made it possible for me to do this. And they didn't have to do it because there wasn't this special thing about them. And I used to think, no, it's not like that at all. I chose what I took to be the best of a bad job, and I'm running with it. You know, if there had been an easier option, an option I could have taken, I would have taken it. I'm not looking after Mum because I'm a saint. I'm looking after Mum because she's ill. She needs looking after. You would do it too if you found yourself in that situation. And there wasn't a home available. I mean, there are all sorts of if-nots. So, okay, I'm no saint. Did it let others off the hook? I mean, there were an awful lot of people, I think, let themselves off the hook by thinking that I was a saint, that I had something special about me that let me do this, which isn't true at all, as no doubt you'll hear in a minute. Okay, all sorts of things like telling the truth. Should I always have told Mum the truth? Well, the thing at the time was, yes, you should bring these people with dementia, back to reality. You should try and force them to live in the real world and so on. And in the beginning, I mean, on the whole, I am a natural truth teller. I would rather tell the truth than anything else, and especially someone like my mum, who's very good at accepting the truth, even if they're hard truths. But I remember one time I found her downstairs in the hall with her hat and coat on. And I said, oh, hello, Mum, where are you going? And she said, I'm going to see your father. Oh, I thought, you know, Dad had been dead for about 5 years by that time, so I told her this. And oh dear, I wish I hadn't, because her face crumpled, and it's bad enough to mourn somebody once, to have to do it again 5 years later, because she had forgotten. And, you know, why did I tell her the truth? That was so stupid. I should have said, well, I'll come with you, Mum, and take her around the block. And by the time we got back, I could have got her talking about something completely different. She would have completely forgotten that she was going to look for Dad. So I think the idea that I should always have told her the truth is complete crap, if you'll forgive me. And I haven't believed that at all since. I have a friend, Trish, whose mother had also fairly recently died of Alzheimer's, and her mum used to want to ring her mum, so the mother's mother. So Trish used to dial as if she was dialing, you know, keeping her finger on the button or whatever you do these days, and she'd say, hello, I'm sorry, it's engaged at the moment, we'll ring her later on. Left her mother feeling happy. It was a wonderful thing to do, and I wish I'd done that on this occasion, and there were other occasions as well. When I was tidying up her house in order for her to come and move with me, I made her the promise that I wouldn't. She was very worried about this. She really didn't want me to get rid of anything. And so, in order to smooth the way, I promised her that I wouldn't get rid of anything without telling her. Oh boy, was that stupid, because what I didn't realise is she had every coffee jar she had ever bought, because why would you throw away a perfectly good jar, which could become useful at one, and string, bits of string that were tied up. I mean, once they couldn't go in the cupboards anymore, she'd put them in the loft. She had my brother, who's 15 years older than I am. She had his first school cap. The loft was very interesting when I opened it up. In the end, I thought, I can't do this. It's just got to go. And so, under cover of darkness, I took away a whole load of things that she would have fought tooth and nail for. Everything had a pair. This is part one of a pair. It's one of a pair. You can't get rid of one. So there are all sorts of reasons why I couldn't get rid of this, whatever it was. Well, should I have kept the promise that I made to her? Well, I didn't think so in the end, because it just became impossible. So does moral obligation lapse when somebody gets dementia, or does it simply change? And is it the case, Kant, in some of the examples he gives the impression that once you've taken on a moral obligation, you've got to keep it up? That certainly wasn't how I felt. I felt that it was perfectly permissible to not tell her the truth occasionally and to break promises that I should never have made. I mean, actually, I ended up not making promises rather than breaking promises. An awful lot of putting myself first. I mean, this bit about not knowing what your intentions are or what your motivations are. All sorts of things, like I used to deceive her a lot. For example, when I was a child, she used to put me to bed, me and my younger brother, to bed at 6 o'clock, even in midsummer, and this was until I was about 12. And when later on I asked her why she had gone in for this cruelty, she said, "I couldn't bear you another minute." She was honest like that, my mum. Anyway, I knew exactly what she meant later on, because when she was living with me, I couldn't bear her another minute after about 6 o'clock. And as I describe in one of the blogs that you've got there, I used to, we'd watch the 6 o'clock news and I'd start yawning, and this would start mum yawning. I'd say, "Goodness, I'm tired." And she'd say, she's very biddable, my mother, "but I'm tired too." And going to bed after the news was a normal thing, because that's what she and my father used to do all the time. So halfway through the news, when the advertisements came on, I would use my little thing that turned the television off, and I'd say, "Oh, that's it, finished time, we've got to," and take her up to bed and put her to bed and leave her there. Was that morally acceptable? It's understandable, isn't it? And the fact that I had the fact that she had done it to me helps, of course, because, like you say, it's your own fault. But I do feel bad looking back on it. She spent an awfully long time in bed. Okay, patronising her. Now, I was going to use an example for this. What was my example for this? I can't remember. I'll come back to that when I think of it. Okay, I used to force her to do things that she didn't want to do. For example, we'd go for a walk, and she'd want to sit down. And I'd be thinking, "Oh, God, I'm determined," because I was trying to work full-time and do all sorts of things at the same time. Didn't have time for her to sit down. So I wouldn't let her sit down, or I'd let her sit down and then have her up again in 1 minute. I mean, all sorts of things like this. So there are all sorts of things I was making her do. And looking back on, I see now that I could have been more patient. I could have factored into what I was doing. But I'm sure that if she was thinking back over my childhood, she could also think, "Well, actually, if I had it over again, I could have done it differently." So again, perhaps not, but I did do this because I had my own agenda and she had to fit it. There was a time, I remember, as things got later, where her dementia was really kicking in and we were getting to the later stages. I was given what's called direct payments. So I was given £402 a week to buy in care to look after her. And I thought this was completely wonderful. I mean, I hadn't had anything at all up until then. So I set up the situation where I had a care agency that was putting... I was told that there was a small team of carers that were going to come in. And I had my own timetable. I thought, "Well, this is great, that's mum out of the way. I will go into town, I'll go and sit in Cafe Nero and work in a corner with my laptop and get a lot done, and then I'll go swimming at lunchtime, and then I'll come back and I'll go home finally, and the carer can then go home, and, you know, this is fine." And what I didn't realise until later on is that, far from being a small team of carers, mum had 11 different carers in that first week. She didn't know whether she was coming or going. What brought it to my attention was getting home, and the carer had gone. So I found mum on her own, and she was cowering in a corner, And I couldn't work out why. I eventually realised that she could see there's a plant in the corner, and the light was casting the leaves of the plant on the wall, on the ceiling. And she thought this was an intruder, you know, sort of something to be frightened of. And she'd only been on her, well, the carer assured me that she'd only been on her own for 5 minutes, but even so, 5 minutes. And I realised that I hadn't thought of her at all when I had been organising all this. I was so relieved to have the opportunity to be able to do some work and so on, that I was just treating her as an object to be moved around. So again, we have another Kantian influence here, because instead of treating her as an end in herself, she was being treated as a tool for my ends. Using mum as a moral trump card. Well, that's a good one. If anyone wanted me to do anything I didn't want to do, oh, I can't. my mum's got dementia, you know. A mother with dementia who lives with you is a really good moral trump card. You really shouldn't, but you do. Or I did, anyway. Especially you saw her siblings. Undermining mum's dignity. Well, that's a very difficult one. It's amazing how many people compare looking after somebody with dementia with looking after children. And I can see there are similarities. Of course there are similarities, but there are huge differences as well. And one difference is that with a child you can exercise your adult prerogative because I say so. Mum used to say that to me, because I say so. You can't say that to your mother. It was very important all the time that I was at least paying lip service to mum's dignity and not undermining it so she could... But actually, it's easier to say that than to do it. I find at the beginning, often she would... I understood it as lying. I now see it as she had strategies to stop people seeing how little memory she had. And one of her strategies was just to pretend. So she'd say something blatantly false. And instead of thinking, oh, mum is using the strategy to, you know, I'd say, oh, mum, you can't say that. This, you know, again, why? Why was I doing that? Why was it necessary to do that? And a really interesting thing about caring for somebody with dementia, it puts your integrity under a spotlight. You learn a lot about yourself when you're caring for somebody else in a situation like this. But you might say at the same time, and certainly I would say this as well, I'm not dissing myself for having done all these things. I think I did a good job under very difficult circumstances. And Kant talks about when you treat rationality as always an end in itself. He says quite categorically, rationality in yourself, in another, or in yourself. And if you think of the Bible says love others as yourself. Not love others instead of yourself, but love others as yourself. You are allowed to love yourself. You're allowed to treat yourself as an end. And if I hadn't occasionally put myself first, I would have hit the ball much earlier than I did. So I had to do these things. It's very easy looking back on it to condemn yourself for things that actually are entirely understandable when you're in that situation. But all sorts of... What did I mean by patronising mum? I had a good example for you, and it's really... I shall remember in the middle of Alex's talk. And I'm sorry, Alex, but I'll have to shut you up. interactions with others. This is another thing that comes under the spotlight when you're caring for somebody in this situation. I have three siblings. I'm a middle one. I've got two much older siblings. They're still full siblings, but there's a 12-year gap between sort of two pairs. My siblings did nothing. At least that's how I saw it. And I think they'd probably accept that they did nothing. And at the time, it made me spit and hiss. I was furious with them, absolutely furious with them. And our relationships haven't really recovered from that, my relationship with my sister in particular. But again, looking back from the distance, it's 9 years now since Mum died, a lot of it, I think, was that I had taken the care of Mum on my own shoulders without giving them the opportunity to help, if you see what I mean. If I had my time again, I would go to them and I'd say, look, Mum is ill, what's going to happen? Now, I did that. Officially, I did that. Nothing was done without their permission. But we got to their permission after I'd already decided what was going to be done, if you see what I mean. So I think my desire to control the situation made it very difficult for me to allow my siblings to help. So I can't blame them entirely for not having helped, except I do think they could have pushed a little bit harder, perhaps, to help. So co-carers, some people were completely brilliant. My mother's brother and his wife were absolutely fantastic. They helped whenever they could. But professionals, there's another difficult thing. We'd go to the doctor, and there'd be Mum and I sitting there, and the doctor would say, well, Leslie, we knew the doctor quite well. Do you take any medication? Oh, no, said Mum. No, I never take pills, no, I'm very healthy. And so in order not to undermine her dignity, I'm trying to signal behind her head that she takes loads of pills, for this, that or the other. And it used to bug me that I hadn't been asked beforehand to provide this information. So, because I completely understand the doctor speaking to Mum, because that's a way of conveying dignity, isn't it? But at the same time, when you've got somebody with dementia, especially late-stage dementia, you've got a situation where somebody isn't going to answer you truthfully because they don't know what the truth is. And so you've actually got to ask the carer. I saw in the paper that a judge, was he a judge or somebody from the Court of Protection, was saying that he wouldn't have a lasting power of attorney. Now, I'm very angry with that man, because he was saying it's much better to have a deputy, which is a receiver, which is what I was for Dad. Actually, without a lasting power of attorney, you're completely stymied as a carer. Dad didn't have one, and it cost us thousands of pounds, and it took us to the court. I had to apply to the Court of Protection for any bit of money that I wanted to use for his care. I had to apply for a court order. Court order would take 2 months to come through, and they didn't understand about decimal points. So I'd ask for £100 and I'd get £1,000, or I'd ask for £1,000 and I'd get £10,000, or £100, or, it seemed to be completely arbitrary. And then you go back and you have to ask for another court order, and so it goes on. I mean, it was a complete nightmare. And here's this chap saying, don't take one. It's clear he's never cared for someone with dementia. You'd think he'd know from working at the Court of Protection. Officials. There are a lot of officials around when you're caring for someone with dementia. There are a lot of people who are in charge of something, especially at the council or here, there and everywhere. And, of course, every carer is like a tightly coiled spring. They're ready to get... whenever there's a slightest opportunity. And you'd be amazed how often these officials would give you an opportunity to do this. But of course, actually, because you're so tightly coiled, there's somebody who's, in absolute sincerity saying she can't do this or something, and you're going off like a firework, and this poor girl can't do anything. And you're unable, or I found myself unable, and I think I wasn't the only one, to hold yourself back and see things reasonably. That's why you have to go on to Prozac, because once you're serene... bystanders. I remember taking Mum shopping in times when I still did take her shopping. She was like, my mum loved children. And seeing a child, she would swoop on it and cover it with kisses and give it a big hug. And of course, when she does this from behind to a completely strange child who's only about 3 years old or something, well, the child goes off like an alarm clock, and the mother comes running from wherever she is, and there's a huge amount of calming down and explaining that has to be done. And of course, this, you sometimes get the people who say, well, she shouldn't be out anyway, which is such a horrible thing. But at the same time, I mean, that's why I'm so keen on this dementia-friendly exercise that the Alzheimer's Society is doing, the dementia-friendly society. Because if people understand, I mean, yes, mum shouldn't attack her three-year-old child from behind, it's bad form. But, I mean, there are all sorts of things like that you have to smooth down, and of course they come from nowhere. Although I did get canny about children, as soon as I saw a child I would take mum off in the other direction. Euthanasia. Now, I have to think about this, because when mum got into the end stages, there were times, I mean, there was one time when she, I was told that I had been entitled for the last 2 years to 6 weeks a year respite care. Now, the reason I hadn't known about this is when I'd rung up to find out about things like this, I was told that I could get any assessment I liked, but as they didn't have any money, I wouldn't get anything, so there wasn't much point. So I didn't pursue it. I think you probably wouldn't either. So then I discovered that I'd been entitled to this 6 weeks. Anyway, the first time I discovered this, I was on my knees. So the thought of her having a week in a home while I was catching up with myself was just bliss. And I was told, as you are at boarding school, not to ring up, you know, because it's better if they have time on their own. Anyway, I had a wonderful week, and I was looking forward to seeing mum when she came back, but the bus pulled up, and she had her hands on the window, and she looked like a Belsen victim. And she looked, and she saw me, and she burst into floods of tears. And she sobbed, and she sobbed, and she sobbed, and she kept saying, I'm a terrible person, I'm a terrible person, I need to die, I hate myself. I didn't know what happened. And how do I know? She couldn't tell me. She wouldn't go to sleep, she had to look under the bed, she wouldn't go in the bathroom at all. I don't know what had happened in the bathroom, but something had. Anyway, that was a turning point, that respite, because she didn't ever fully recover from that. And there's quite a long time when she was wanting to die. She wanted to die, and I wanted her to die as well. I could cheerfully have killed her on quite a few occasions. And I did a lot of thinking about euthanasia at the time. I was thinking, well, this is difficult, because I don't know what I'm going to say next. No, okay, nothing. I'm just going to say that. I would have killed her if I thought it was the right thing to do. I'd promised her, she saw her own mother die from cancer in the years when pain relief wasn't what it is these days. And she had made me promise as a young child, well, a girl, not a child perhaps, that if she was ever in that situation, I would end her life for her. And God help me, I did promise it. So I felt, I would have done it if I felt it was the right thing to do. But at no point could I be sure. If I was killing her for her sake, that's okay, I would have done that. If I was killing her for my sake, that's murder. And if I was doing that, it wasn't the right thing to do. And I didn't know why I was doing it. It would have been very easy to do at various times, although I'm told it's a lot harder than you think it is, by people who are not in a position to know, I hope. The whole euthanasia thing, it worries me. I hear the arguments of the dignity in dying people. I hear the arguments of those who want assisted suicide and so on. I think it's... The fact is, many of us want assisted suicide because we are afraid of dementia. Actually, dementia is the one thing you cannot have assisted suicide for, because you can't. Somebody with dementia has not got mental competency, and therefore they can't say that they want to die. If they've got an advanced directive, living will or something like that, which mum did have, that says if you've got a condition that's going to take you off, then you should be allowed to die, you shouldn't be resuscitated. So it doesn't really capture the situation that Mum and I were in. But for a long time, I really think that people underestimate the real difficulty. Because what would have happened if I had killed Mum? Who would have denounced me? Nobody. Everyone would have understood. Now, that's fine if I was doing it because she wanted to die and I wanted to do the right thing by her and it was really a case of mercy killing, etc. But if it was a case of wanting my inheritance a little bit earlier, how would anyone have known the difference? Because I would have been saying, oh, Mum was in a terrible state, she wanted to die, that's why I put the pillow over her head. Nobody else could have known whether I was doing that in order to get my inheritance early or in order to put Mum out of her misery. I wouldn't have known if I was doing it because she wanted to die or because I wanted her to die. Even I wouldn't have known. So how the hell else could people tell? So I'm really in two minds on the idea of euthanasia. Although this is a special case when you've got somebody who hasn't got mental competence. I think when somebody does have mental competence, that's a very different situation. So, if you want to be forced to question your moral standing in your own eyes or in the eyes of everybody else, become a carer for somebody with dementia. And that's Mum. That's her age 17. She looks like Catherine Zeta-Jones, I think. And that's her when she was 83. And she was a lovely person. She really was. And that's the book I wrote. It's the one that Fawzia was. So, okay, that's it. We've got 5 minutes. Okay. Chris.
You said when you were looking at some of the moral issues that you came to it from a standpoint of Kant and deontology. I might argue your subsequent actions were nearly all explained by utilitarianism. For instance, when you said in retrospect you would not have told your mother that her husband or father had died, I would have said that was a utilitarian argument, not a deontological argument.
I was talking about it seemed a deontological imperative when the question came up of whether I should look after or not. But I agree there were an awful lot of utilitarian considerations later on. An awful lot. But there was an awful lot of also of treating myself as an end in myself as well. Because if I hadn't done, I wouldn't have been able to look after as long as I did.
Isn't that part of a utilitarian argument that you're looking at the good, the happiness, if you like, on the whole, the two of you, and balancing it in some way?
You can look at it like that if you like. I prefer to look at it as treating myself as an end. I am also a person with value. Mum is not the only person with value here. And she's not the only person with emotions here. My emotions... I mean, I remember one occasion when I was kneeling by the bed putting on her socks. And I looked up just in time to see her kick me intentionally. Mm-hmm. She chose to bring her leg up right in my... And I was so, so angry. I had to take myself out of the room and close the door because otherwise I would have responded in kind. And that was a case where people think, I mean, the person with dementia, they're considering their emotions, but actually the carer has emotions that must be considered too. And both Kant and utilitarianism can deal with this in their different ways. I think Kant does it better.
Did the doctor propose any psychological help for you to do the full
Prozac? God, it's brilliant. And when I hit a brick wall, Valium. That's also brilliant.
That's what I want to say. Did you look for that yourself, or were you considered as part of the disease of your mother? So did the doctor suggest that you also see somebody?
Well, there was an occasion towards the end where I went to see Mum's consultant. And when I went to see our GP on the back of this visit to the consultant, the GP, who was a friend, read out to me that the consultants had said, I think the mother's fine, but I think the daughter should be checked. And I that was really, I mean, ever since then the consultant has become a friend, but that was such a good insight, because it was absolutely right. I needed help at that point. Frank?
On this question of undermining, I can see the reluctance to do things that would undermine the mother by treating her like a child. On the other hand, if she had gone to a home, the home sort of has the kind of authority that teachers do at a school, haven't they? And
well, I hope not.
Well,
I would hope to choose a home where the people in the home would treat the inmates as adults. I mean, it's true that sometimes, okay, patronising, you have come up, luckily it's just before your lecture. And it's gone again. Oh, it came into my mind and now it's gone again. That's so frustrating. Maybe it'll come back in a minute. Sorry, Frank, I can't answer that. You had a question too.
I was wondering how your view of her as a person changed. Has she lost her memory? Did she lose her memory of you?
It's interesting. She never stopped being my mum. She always recognised me, so she didn't recognise me. She didn't. She thought I was her mum. The night she was dying, she called me mum. And I was happy with that. I remember once my younger brother came to stay. She did fail to recognise my siblings, which isn't surprising given how little they were. But my younger brother came to see her and she threw her arms around and gave him a big hug and she said, "I don't know who you are, but I know I love you." And I thought that was wonderful. So she still had, there was a core of who she was still there right up to the very end. But she lost, she was always a very rational, very intellectual person. And that
and
went.
You saw her as the same person?
I saw her as the same person, but I was, one thing that I think I got right, and I think quite unusually perhaps, is that I was able to take the place where she was at as the place where she was at. I wasn't always hankering after, mum would have hated this, oh God, mum would have hated this. That mum wasn't there anymore. And there's no point in hankering after the person she was, had been. She was now this person. And it was this person that had to be kept happy and had to be accorded dignity and what have you. But I do think that there are a lot of people who do hanker after, you know, and they're really made unhappy by the fact that the person would have hated it. But I can't see any point in thinking of it like that. I can't, but then I didn't do that.
You know, we were taught the last two talks to mentioning the connection between body and mind and body and the emotional connection with physical diseases.
Indeed, yeah.
How does that work with mental diseases? We always seem to use physical illness.
Well, I think dementia is a very good case in point. It's an illustration of the fact that this is, there are both physical and mental aspects to this disease. I mean, mum was hugely physically fit. And she lasted 10 years after the diagnosis of dementia. But her brain wasn't, and her brain is part of her body. I completely agree, and I do think that a lot of the frustration from dementia comes not from the disease. I mean, it's very interesting that people think that Alzheimer's leads to anger. Whereas actually, I was told by her consultant that whatever somebody was like before they had dementia, they will be more like that after dementia. And it's true, I think, certainly in my experience. My mother was always a really nice person and a really happy person. And she became happier and, you know, full of the joys of spring. I mean, it was actually when I wasn't stressed out of my mind, I could actually really enjoy this. We used to go for walks and admire the hedges and admire the cats and the silver cars, and we'd look at the plane and its vapour trail over the sky, and, you know, this is nice.
I can't remember where I'm going on this.
Your nature.
Yes, her nature, but at the respite care and so on, there was a lot of frustration when she wasn't getting what she needed, and of course she couldn't get what she needed, partly because she couldn't tell anybody what she needed. The home gave up cleaning her teeth. I had always been scrupulous about her teeth, but the home gave up. And I was just thinking, so when her teeth start falling out, when she starts getting toothache, what's going to happen? Is somebody in end-stage dementia, you can't send them to a dentist. You know, she's not going to lie there and open her mouth and have somebody poking around in it without biffing him in the nose. I think one more question, or 40 is going to get really...
Thank you. You're obviously not a saint.
Thank you.
You've been very brave. Thank you. I want to come back to the sort of question that we're working around all the time. These papers, for example, describe a long exploration of what it is to be a person, to have an identity.
So when you say these papers, what are my handout?
I think so. The self-perception.
That's coming next. So
very good, very good. However, also without a conclusion.
I can't answer questions on Alex's paper, I'm afraid.
What you describe, it seems to me, is the death of the soul.
No, not in the slightest.
No.
My mum, right up till the moment she dies, was herself. Mm. There was a core of her there. Her soul, I have difficulty with that word a little bit, but her spirit was there. And in fact, that's why I didn't put her into a home in the first place. Because it was important to me that I did what I could to keep that spirit alive, that essential mumness. I said earlier, I've never regretted caring for her for all that time, even at the cost to me that it extracted at times, and that was because her spirit remained alive.
Thank you. So what was lost?
Her memory.
Just the memory.
Well, her memory and her rationality, her cognition.
Yes,
her cognition was...
I ask for a personal reason also. I am becoming very forgetful. I saw many in this room walk into a room and think, no, what did I come here for? I can't remember.
Well, if that were a sign of dementia, we'd all have it.
You know, it also has to be more alert to the possibility that dementia creeps up on us unaware. Was your mother ever aware that things were going wrong?
At the beginning, yes. It was later on she had no insight at all. She used to think she was caring for me, which was bloody irritating.
Thank you.
Well, could we give Marianne a...